Welcome to Dialogue, a program that explores the world of ideas and issues in national and international affairs, history, and culture. I'm George Liston C.A. In the 1840s, the Irish liberator Daniel O'Connell said of America that something in the atmosphere poisoned the well of human sympathy where white attitudes towards blacks were concerned. That something is central to the racialized identities that are still so influential in American life. When O'Connell spoke, the American dilemma centered on the existence of slavery. Today, a spirited debate continues over affirmative action. It's a debate that requires us to understand how notions of race and class interact in America. My guest is Bruce Nelson, Associate Professor of History at Dartmouth College. Bruce, welcome to Dialogue.
Thanks very much.
Bruce, I want to begin our conversation with a particular moment in history, selecting the year 1964, when then-Governor George Wallace of Alabama took his presidential primary campaign northward. In doing so, Bruce, he met with a rousing reception, and by that I mean positive, in many northern cities, a fact which surprised many people.
Yes.
Clearly, George Wallace understood something others did not. What was it?
Well, Wallace was elected governor of Alabama in 1962. And in January of 1963, when he gave his inaugural address in Montgomery, the state capital, he made his ringing affirmation of segregation today, segregation tomorrow, segregation forever. But Wallace was a very ambitious man. In other words, he crystallized the white backlash in Alabama and the Deep South. He became a very important regional spokesman, as well as statewide spokesman, for the white backlash that had been gathering steam for more than a decade in opposition to the civil rights movement and toward equal rights for African Americans in American society. But Wallace, as I said, was a very ambitious man, and he really wanted to prove that there was no Mason-Dixon line when it came to racial attitudes among whites in the United States. And he wanted to take his show, if you will. He wanted to take his political ambition to a national level. And so he did something quite remarkable. He decided to enter a number of primaries, presidential primaries in northern states, to run against the incumbent, Lyndon Baines Johnson, to challenge him for the presidential nomination. Johnson himself was a Southerner, but Johnson was also strongly committed to civil rights, and toward the passage of what became the Civil Rights Act of 1964. And Wallace wanted to challenge Johnson on that score, and he wanted to challenge him among Northerners. He wanted to demonstrate that the Democratic Party's sort of base constituency in the North was not necessarily committed to the passage of civil rights legislation.
And in fact, point of fact, he did that. And what you're saying is that he suspected that backlash was not a regional phenomenon,
yes,
but was in fact a national one.
Yes, yes.
Do you know what's remarkable, Bruce, and it's a focus of your work, that in doing so, in getting this backlash reaction in northern communities, he got it substantially from working class communities, white working class communities, at the same time that those workers were getting the messages from their unions,
yes,
that integration and civil rights advancement were the real message. They were rejecting that message. That's phenomenal. Let me see if these two statements make sense to you, to Bruce, that in this backlash reaction, we're seeing, first of all, a division between labor union leadership and rank-and-file attitudes.
Right.
And does that, in turn, Bruce, suggest that we're seeing also an instance of something that you, again, has historical roots, that we might call limits to class solidarity when race becomes a factor? I mean, when the racial identity becomes, in the minds of people, superior to notions of class unity.
Yeah. Well, I would have to agree with both of those statements. I'm writing a book now in which I'm trying to come to terms with those issues, precisely those issues, mainly in the 20th century, but over a longer period of time as well. And I guess I would offer one friendly amendment, though, and that is to say it's not simply a matter of class over race or race over class. In other words, it's not always a matter, or it's not simply a matter, that is, of workers choosing their, or white workers now, choosing their racial identities over their class identities. One of the things that I've tried to get at is how those identities are intertwined. how one might say that class becomes a racialized category, that workers understand that white workers, and I think we have to be very careful to sort of speak, you know, in qualified ways here, but white workers see their life experience, if you will, their place in the world and in the social order in racialized terms. And so what we might identify as a class identity is also a racialized identity, as a racial component to it. And the two, as I said, become intertwined in ways that are, at least in the eyes of the beholder, virtually inseparable.
This is important. I accept your friendly amendment because I think it's right to the heart of the story. And I certainly don't want to oversimplify any point here because they're all so important. I get a sense, though, that one could almost say whiteness is a kind of a class. And this suggests to me something I really would like to hear you speak to, Bruce, that black must have a definition, therefore, that is complex and more than a question of skin color and more than a question of race.
Right.
And what is blackness, then, or what historically when we look at this kind of self-definition? Well, or definition imposed on others?
That's a huge question, and I'm not the best qualified person to address it, but let me try since I'm here. There has been some very exciting developments in scholarship in recent years, certainly among historians, but among people in cultural studies, literary criticism, and a number of other different fields as well. And that is trying to understand that race is not an inherent phenomenon, but race is a kind of social construct, as we say. Race is socially and culturally constructed at a given historical moment, and its meaning changes over time. And when you look at the issue of skin color, you have to look at also the many cultural attributes that go along with it. That skin color becomes a badge with a much larger meaning than simply skin color itself. There's a very interesting book by a man named Noel Ignatieff called How the Irish Became White. And I've used this book with students or chapters out of it, and they are kind of flabbergasted. In other words, they have a tendency to look at white, you know, white. How did they become white? They were white. In other words, you think it's something intrinsic. You look in the mirror, you see white. Well, their assumption is that the Irish were white to begin with. They were white when they got off the boat, and the difference in their skin color would sharply differentiate them from African Americans. But if you look at whiteness as a quality, rather than merely a color, if you look at it as a series of attributes and, if you will, badges of status in the society, then the Irish had something to prove. The Irish came here as a despised peasant people. The Irish came here in the middle of the 19th century, especially as a people who emaciated in many cases, not only from the ocean voyage, but from the absolutely catastrophic effects of the Great Famine in Ireland. And so they came to the United States, oftentimes in a diseased and emaciated condition. They sort of entered the lower echelons of the labor market. They were Catholic, which in the United States was right. The equivalent, you know, of being a communist in the 20th century. In other words, they were seen as sort of fundamentally alien in a value sense. And in order to become accepted as Americans, the Irish, they weren't going to become Protestant, because they did have a deep allegiance to Catholicism. And the Catholic Church was one of the most important institutional foundation stones of their life in the United States as they became a people, as they became a kind of hyphenated, you know, Irish-American people. So, you know, they became white. They became white by, you know, and I look at it sort of in labor market terms, but it's much more than that. I mean, there's all, because as I said, these are value-laden terms.
They are value-laden terms, and you're quite right, and it comes forth in your writing that it goes well beyond the labor market and well beyond this century. And so these attitudes are long-standing, and they're essentially the kind of tender that gets lit again in our century when Wallace goes north and that kind of thing.
Yes.
It's there.
Yes. In fact, one of the things that's most remarkable about Wallace's effect in the North and his success in the North is that he's not just speaking to white workers, but he's speaking to workers who in many cases are from Southern and Eastern Europe. And Wallace is speaking to them, especially when he gives a very famous speech on the evening of April 1st in Milwaukee. It's at St. Sava's Orthodox Church. It's an overwhelmingly Eastern European, Polish, Yugoslav, and other Eastern European constituency. And these are the people, you see, who had been the core constituency of the New Deal. These were the people who benefited from the New Deal, who benefited, I would say all Americans did in many ways, or maybe that's a controversial statement, but certainly the great majority of Americans did in many ways. But first and foremost, it was these folks whose security and whose status was kind of had a foundation built under it by the New Deal. And the same thing was true of the union movement of the 1930s and the kinds of collective bargaining agreements, the kind of privatized welfare state, if you will, that emerged for the members of those unions. Mm-hmm. You know, they began to have vacations with pay. They began to have health care. They began to have a whole array of benefits that had been unimaginable for their parents and grandparents.
You know, the interesting thing, though, Bruce, to me, among many interesting points you're making, though, is that this later wave of immigrants that you're talking about now from Eastern Europe, Southern Europe,
right.
et cetera,
right.
with their own different cultural differences and so forth, still also found, did they not, at some point, the same interest in a definition of whiteness
yes.
as being
yes.
central to their self-identification.
Yes. Yes. And one of the most fascinating examples of this is the Italians. And again, one has to be wary of sort of overgeneralizing here. But for one thing, Italy is a fairly large country with distinctions within. But southern Italians, even in Italy, were looked down upon by northern Italians and were perceived as racially different. And again, the term race was used in very broad ways for a very long time. People would talk about the Irish race, the Italian right. race. And, you know, they would use the word race where we would use the word nationality. Mm-hmm. And one of the chapters in my book is about the New York waterfront and about the sort of long evolution of the waterfront workforce and the kinds of rivalries that existed there and developed and changed over time. The waterfront was an Irish enclave. It didn't start as an Irish enclave, but it became an Irish enclave. And one of the most observant commentator on the and best informed commentator on the New York waterfront in the late 19th and early 20th century made the point that as late as the 1880s, the waterfront of New York, which was huge, by the way, by far the biggest port in the world then, mm-hmm. was 95% Irish, with a smattering of other Northern European peoples. In a strike in 1887, the Italians are introduced as strikebreakers, and by about 1914, the Italians are between a third and a half of the total workforce. Now, what's interesting is that the Italians are not regarded as white. And when they refer to white men, and this wasn't just on the waterfront, this was throughout much of the society, white men and the work that white men do, they were not referring to Italians and sometimes not referring to other immigrants from Southern and Eastern Europe, as I say, this was most sharply posed in relationship to Italians. And so it was said on the New York waterfront in the 19-teens that one white man can do the work of two or three Italians. Mm-hmm. Or that a stevedore, a hiring, in other words, someone who hired people to do dock labor, would say that I hire seven white gangs and one Italian gang to load and unload my ships, you see.
Yeah.
And then along comes E. Franklin Frazier, who does a study of the relatively small numbers of black longshoremen in New York in the early 1920s. And one of the points that he makes is, you know, that the Irish are extremely anti-black, and there's a terrific sort of sense of antagonism between the Irish and blacks. But Italians have been softer, if you will, in their attitudes toward blacks, less quick to discriminate, more willing to work on the same ship with them, and so on. And he says, however, that lately the Italians have been assimilating the prejudices of the Irish. And what he's getting at, of course, is that the Italians are becoming white. Their ticket to full acceptance in American society in their own minds, and their ticket to a status as a white man and a white worker, and the privileges that go along with it, by the way, which are both psychic and material privileges, that those their ticket to that is to distinguish themselves more clearly and sharply from blacks.
This is a riveting point, and I deeply appreciate that historical detail and the anecdote about the story about the longshoremen, because one of the phrases you use, I think, goes to the heart of this, quote, the wages of whiteness,
right.
the definition of certain jobs as, quote, white jobs, others as black jobs. Obviously, some is desirable, others is not so desirable,
right.
or extremely undesirable.
Right.
And that these attitudes have been flowing through our society for quite some time.
Right, hmm. right.
You know, I'll tell you something, Bruce. When you think of this historical record and the strength of it, the passionate strength of it. I think we can use the word passion here because attitudes do get pretty much stirred up on this. It's amazing to me that in the 1930s, you chart a moment when the labor unions, and here I do simplify, but it seems to me they began to campaign against it. I mean, it's particularly the CIO, I suppose, for its own, some of its own reasons in marshaling unskilled labor. But they began to mount a major integrationist campaign, so to speak.
Yes.
Aren't they swimming against the current?
Well, to some degree, they're swimming against the current. But the CIO, although it was in many ways a mainstream institution, or became one certainly, it also had not insignificant numbers of left-wingers, of socialists and communists in its leadership. And they had a strong ideological commitment to racial equality. And so, they tended to privilege class over race, but at the same time, they believed in racial equality, and they were willing to stick their necks out for it in ways that many other people were not.
Yeah.
And so that sort of combination of both sort of strategic necessity and ideological commitment led the CIO to push to try to achieve racial equality in the way that few other forces in American society had ever tried to do up until that point. And in the early days of the CIO, they did it with some success, some remarkable success.
And that's exactly what I want to ask you, because we've been focusing on the limits of solidarity within the labor union around issues of race and so forth. But when the CIO set out to overcome that, how successful did they get to be, Bruce? What did they achieve?
Well, first of all, they were successful in a basic sense, and that is that they did open up their unions to workers regardless of color. In the South, it was a little more complicated, but even there, in the steel industry, for example, in Birmingham, white workers who were pro-union pretty quickly came to understand that the shape of the union was one thing, but the question of inclusion was already answered, in effect, and that is, you had to include black workers if the union was to succeed. Because blacks were, especially in the South, in an industry like steel, were a large enough component of the labor force that unless you organized them, you couldn't succeed in organizing a union.
Those numbers were essential.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. And so in places like Birmingham and a number of other sort of deep South industrial cities, these unions, as well as in cities like Chicago and Gary and Pittsburgh in the North, these unions successfully brought blacks and whites under the same umbrella in a way that simply had not been done before for the most part.
And is there an additional benefit, Bruce, although a secondary one, and that is what we might call social interaction? I mean, you sketched a picture here of union necessity and philosophic commitment, people really believing that this should be, and then the rank and file understanding they needed numbers.
Yep.
But as they came together, was there any degree of, people socializing with each other or liking each other in ways they might not have anticipated?
I would say we are a pretty segregated society in many ways today in the United States, but we were a much more segregated society in the 1930s. There might have been some, in a city like Chicago, for example, which was one of the great battlegrounds in the building of the CIO, one of the great industrial cities in the United States, and manufacturing cities, and one of the great battlegrounds in the building of the CIO. Whites and blacks tended to live very separate lives. You know, sometimes they interacted on the job, but even the job was organized along racial lines and ethnic lines. You see, the unions really challenged that in a frontal way. And my sense is, and I think there's a lot of evidence to support this, that one, it was a problematic undertaking to begin with, but for the first generation of unionists, the people who had to march on those picket lines, who had to face the real barrage of opposition that they faced from employers and oftentimes from city administrations and state administrations, there was a sense of solidarity. There was a sense of common commitment to the union that transcended racial and ethnic lines. There was a sense that we're all in this together and we need each other.
Yeah.
And therefore, there are these wonderful reports in newspapers like the Pittsburgh Courier, which I guess is still with us today, but which was then the leading black weekly in the United States, which was a very important voice in black America. And there were black scholars like Horace Caton, a sociologist who was associated with the University of Chicago, and St. Clair Drake. They did these ethnographic investigations in among steel and meatpacking and other industrial workers in Chicago in the late 30s. And they found the most remarkable examples of these holding these dances and picnics where there would be that kind of joyous interaction.
Yeah, it's
kind of sense of release, if you will, from all of that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And yet my argument is that as the base of the union movement was broadened, as the union movement reached out and encompassed a larger swath of the working class, and especially the white working class, if you will, a larger swath of white America, it became more and more difficult to sustain that kind of sense mm-hmm. of interracial solidarity.
Yeah.
Again, there's always danger of an oversimplification here, it seems mm-hmm. to me. But I think there's a process of development that goes on here that, and it's ironic and it's tragic, that as the Union broadens its base, as the Union becomes more deeply rooted in the American mainstream, the Union becomes to reflect, then the Union more and more reflects the mores of the larger society.
Let me take a moment from our conversation, Bruce Nelson, just to say that this is Dialogue, a presentation of PRI, Public Radio International. I'm George Liston, CA, and my guest today is Bruce Nelson, Associate Professor of History at Dartmouth College, and currently a Fellow of the Woodrow Wilson Center in Washington, D.C. Bruce, having discussed unions in the 30s and the kinds of advances they were making in, well, in many ways, but certainly in this subject of bringing the races closer together, interracialism, we might call it. It's also clear to me from things you've written that the World War II years were, as you put it again, catalytic, but moving in the opposite direction. And I want to ask you why, but I want to sort of have you phrase your answer in light of things I already know about, such as the massive movement of black workers from the South to the North, the kind of effect that had, what their numbers meant, and this other phenomenon you mentioned of the union movement itself broadening. Mm-hmm. How did all those things cohere to become, as you put it, catalytic in labor change?
Okay. Well, I guess the term that's so important here is the Great Migration. The Great Migration of African Americans from the rural agricultural South to the urban industrial North. It begins around World War I. It accelerates in the 20s. And it accelerates again in an unprecedented way during World War II and continues into the 1960s. In a word, African Americans trampled on white turf. By their very presence, they trampled on white turf. They trampled on white space. They challenged what whites had regarded as their own prerogatives. By their very presence, they did this. And therefore, you have a situation where, for example, the General Motors Company, one of the major employers of industrial labor in the United States and the largest industrial corporation in the world, had very few blacks on its workforce. Well, this changes significantly during World War II. Many manufacturing plants and related industries, if you will, or related concerns, hire significant numbers of African Americans. They need to. I mean, there's pressure from the government to do so. There's pressure from African Americans to do so. But they need to because of labor shortages. And so they turn, sometimes reluctantly, to black workers. And as I said, by their very presence, you know, blacks had been confined to certain areas or they'd been excluded altogether. And when they come into the workforce in significant numbers during the war, their very presence is destabilizing, mm-hmm. not only in the workplace, but in neighborhoods. There was all of this competition for turf. And, you know, the wartime was a remarkable phenomenon. Just people jostled together on buses, you know. They'd be bumping up against each other and so on. And race just seemed to, you know, trigger
yeah.
hostility again and again and again. Not always, but again and again and again. And so you had a great deal of conflict that was racially based. And much of it was centered in the working class because, after all, that's where it happened. You know, it happened in working class neighborhoods. It happened in the factory floor. It didn't happen among white collar workers, you know, and middle management. It happened among the blue collar workers. It happened in blue collar working class neighborhoods and so on.
Is this, Bruce, and all that we're talking about in this sense of assigned identities and characterizations of peoples as less desirable than others and that kind of thing, and then all the derivative things, their jobs not being the jobs you'd want to do, their places to live being separate and so forth. Is that particularly American, or do you find that in other societies?
Well, you certainly, I mean, the racial aspects of it are very distinctively American, although obviously there are racial conflicts in other societies as well. But my family is from Northern Ireland. Mm-hmm. My mother's family comes from just outside of Belfast. And I have begun to study, from a comparative standpoint, the relationship between Protestants and Catholics in Northern Ireland, especially in the workplace, especially focused on the ways in which unions have handled these questions. And it's really quite remarkable to me how deep the divide has continued to be, especially in some parts of the society. How deep the divide has continued to be, how the demonizing of the other is really kind of a fundamental sort of reflex, if you will, in that society, and how it goes on from generation to generation. In fact, in many ways, we've probably made more progress than they have.
I'm glad I asked that question. I really am, because of the, not just the way you were able to establish the comparisons for us, but I know that you are focusing as a scholar on Northern Ireland now with just this particular interest in mind. And you also indicated, Bruce, in that answer, and I was glad to hear this, that we've made some progress.
Yeah.
And I think that's an important note as we conclude our conversation, because I'd like to hear from you, because of the richness of what you've given us, where you see hope, where you see a possibility of, if we can, break this kind of cycle and get away from notions of whiteness being so important to determinations of value and that kind of thing in our society.
Well, I think what's changed, and I'm afraid that this is going to be a little bit not so much on the hopeful side, but I think it's something important to identify, and it's something I'm only trying to understand myself. But one of the things that has changed, it seems to me, is that whiteness has become invisible. And that makes it all the more dangerous. And I think that's something we need to address as a society. I think we need to address the persistence of sort of color encoding, if you will, in the society, and especially look at the white side of that, where, as I said, there's a dangerous tendency to make it normative at the same time that you also make it invisible, refuse to acknowledge it. But yes, I think there are areas of hope, and I'm a cosmic optimist, and, you know, in spite of, I mean, I read a book like Jonathan Cozzel's Savage Inequalities, and it terrifies me. The level of inequality and separation and lack of common human feeling that exists in our society is frightening. And yet, there are positive signs, and there are people who are making a very great contribution to, you know, addressing this, one of the most enduring problems, right, and most fundamental problems that we've had in our society. Mm-hmm. And if I can do that through my work, as well as in the streets, then, I mean, not that I'm a major figure in it, don't get me, I'm not saying that, but if I can make some small contribution to that process, then I will sleep a little better at night anyway.
Bruce Nelson, I want to thank you for this conversation. I don't want to embarrass you at the conclusion of it, but I think you are just such a person. Thank you for being with us today on Dialogue.
Well, thank you, George.
You have been listening to Dialogue. My guest today was Bruce Nelson, Associate Professor of History at Dartmouth College and currently a Fellow of the Woodrow Wilson Center in Washington, D.C. I'm George Liston, C.A., producer and host of Dialogue. Assistant producer is Karen Reed. Our technical director is John Tyler. Dialogue is presented by PRI, Public Radio International, and is a production of the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars in association with Smithsonian Productions. Established by Congress in 1968, the center is our nation's official and living memorial to the 28th President of the United States, Woodrow Wilson.
For cassettes or more information on Dialogue, call us at 303-823-8000. Contact us on America Online at Radio Dial. That's RADIODIAL at AOL.com. Visit our internet webpage at www.ics.si.edu.